Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, 2-1. Welcome to this latest edition of Network Europe. I'm Barbara Gruber. Coming up on the program, as the world's leading experts are about to meet for the 16th International AIDS Conference next week in Toronto, we look at the plight of Romania's HIV-positive children and teenagers. We'll head to Brussels to see how EU members are trying to fight international takeovers. And down to Spain as chaos crosses continents and North Africans head home for summer holidays. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Almost 20,000 scientists, healthcare providers, educators, policymakers and people living with HIV will be gathering at the 16th International AIDS Conference in Toronto next week. The aim is to share current knowledge on this global epidemic that has already killed more than 25 million people and infected another 40 million around the world. Here in Europe, a Human Rights Watch report released last week slammed the Romanian government for failing to integrate more than 7,000 HIV-infected children aged 15 to 19, the largest such group in any European state. The report says the vast and filthy orphanages of the pre-1989 communist regime were a breeding ground for AIDS. And even though most HIV-infected Romanians do have access to free antiretroviral drugs and there are laws to protect them, Romanian society is slow to accept these rights. Ignorance about AIDS remains widespread, and so is discrimination, preventing children and teenagers from attending school, getting health care or jobs, as Cristina Tiberian from Radio Romania International reports.
Discrimination is the main reason why we can't have a normal life. It is a greater enemy than the virus itself.
This is Marius. He is 35 years old and has been living with HIV for 11 years. He doesn't have a job because some days he's just too ill. He has, however, become a member of the Anti-AIDS Romanian Association, which has helped him convey his anti-discrimination message to the public at large. Despite all the hardships that come with HIV, Marius says he is very lucky. His wife and his closest friend accept him just the way he is. The same cannot be said, however, for the more than 7,000 Romanian children and young people that are HIV positive. A Human Rights Watch report released last week says they face widespread discrimination, which prevents many of them from going to school, getting medical care, working, or even learning about their medical condition. Most of these children are aged 15 to 19. They were infected between 1986 and 1990, the last years of communist regime in Romania. Government policies exposed them to contaminated needles and microtransfusions. Small children were injected with unscreened blood, in the mistaken belief that this would improve their immune system. Today, 40% of those HIV-positive teenagers are not in school. For those who do go to school or college, discrimination is so great that many face harassment by teachers and fellow students. This is what happened to 19-year-old Mary, who has been living with HIV for 13 years and takes 22 pills a day.
I was in high school doing a training course to become a beautician and manicurist. A colleague was supposed to do my manicure, and I asked her to use my nail kit. I wanted to protect her, and she said, "What's the matter with you? You've got AIDS or something?" Based on my reaction and on the fact that she had seen me take a lot of pills all the time, she concluded that I did have AIDS. So she called her parents and the police, and they ran tests. Because of the pressure my colleague's parents were putting on the school management, I was expelled.
For a few months now, Mary has been working for a company that offers cleaning services. She hasn't told anyone at work that she's HIV positive because she's afraid she will get fired. According to Human Rights Watch, laws prohibiting discrimination are rarely enforced, and few real sanctions have been reported against those who commit acts of discrimination. Romania's National Council for Combating Discrimination is responsible for changing that. Corina Macoveanu is a member of the council's board. Despite the problems, she says the law to protect against discrimination is improving. 3 weeks ago, the Romanian legislation saw the introduction of a new regulation, the reversed burden of proof. From now on, every time an act of discrimination is committed, it is not the plaintiff, the discriminated person, who has to prove that they were discriminated against. The defendant, the person accused of discrimination, will have to demonstrate that they did not discriminate against the plaintiff. Cases of discrimination will thus be easier to prove.
While the reversed burden of proof may help in some cases, there are still legislative barriers that lead to widespread discrimination, such as mandatory medical testing for a wide variety of jobs where the risk of HIV transmission is minimal. Fighting discrimination is not a question of resources, but a question of political will, says the author of the Human Rights Watch report, Clarissa Bencomo.
What we really need are high-level government officials sending the message that this is an important issue. And they should do it working with the NGOs that have the expertise.
Romania has come a long way toward fulfilling its commitment to provide antiretroviral treatment to those who need it. But children living with HIV need more than just medication. In the coming years, many of them will become sexually active. Human Rights Watch has called on the Romanian government to help them by ensuring they have access to information on reproductive health and to medical care. No government is in place, says Human Rights Watch, to ensure that children living with HIV are able to support themselves without significant assistance when they become ineligible for existing social protection programs as they grow older. HIV-positive youth, such as 19-year-old Mary, thus risk being ostracized and pushed to the sidelines of society. Mary's dreams are those of the girl next door. She wants to have a boyfriend who would love her just as she is. She wants to go to work without the prospect of getting fired hovering over her. And she wants a home to come back to. But she is not the girl next door. And like many other people living with HIV, she has been made to realize that difference comes at a price. Reporting from Bucharest, Cristina Tiberian, Radio Romania International.
And it's time now on the program for our weekly briefing from Brussels with our EU insider Stephen Castle.
Even well into August, officials at the European Commission's Competition Directorate remain at their desks. And this week, while most of their colleagues were lying on the beach, Europe's most powerful regulators launched a new salvo in an undeclared war on economic nationalism within the EU. The past few months have seen a fierce battle over the fate of Europe's energy companies, with a flurry of cross-border bids provoking squeals of protest across the continent. This time, attention has turned to the question of who controls a road network, by coincidence, one that many EU officials probably use during their summer holidays. The European Competition Commissioner, Neelie Kroes, is questioning a decision to block a €14 billion bid for Italy's motorway operator. Ms. Kroes wants the Italian authorities to justify their decision to prevent the takeover of Italy's Autostrada by its Spanish rival Abertis. Italy says its law rules out such a bid because Abertis owns a construction business. This, so the argument goes, creates the risk of a conflict of interest. Whether that will convince Ms. Kroes remains to be seen, but the row is a crucial test case. Italy has a new government led by Romano Prodi, a former European Commission president and an economic liberal. Yet even a free marketeer like Mr. Prodi isn't keen to sell a national asset like Italy's road network to the highest foreign bidder. This isn't the first time the Commission has clashed like this with Rome. It forced the previous Italian government to back down after it blocked a foreign takeover of one of Italy's banks. But this row also comes against the background of the dispute over energy takeovers. Spain opposes a merger of its power giant Endesa with the German rival E.ON. Meanwhile, an Italian company, Enel, complains bitterly that France is preventing it from bidding for the French firm Suez. Does all this herald a growing tide of protectionism in Europe? Not necessarily. Amid the howls of protest, the first thing to remember is that countries are hardly consistent in the way they approach such a touchy issue. Rome resisted a foreign takeover of one of its banks, and now its motorways, while backing the right of Italy's Enel to buy a French utility. Madrid wants a Spanish firm to buy Italy's motorway network, yet it's fighting tooth and nail to prevent Spain's power group Endesa being taken over by Germany's E.ON. In other words, most countries see an advantage in open markets, particularly if they're abroad. and that suggests that clear and consistent rules across the EU are crucial. Moreover, European companies are attempting cross-border bids which would have been inconceivable a decade ago. Inevitably, efforts by foreign firms to buy banks, energy utilities, or parts of the transport network will provoke controversy. But Europe's single market is allowing companies to attempt deals they would once never even have tried. And EU regulators believe it's worth postponing their summer holidays to uphold the right to do so. This is Stephen Castle in Brussels.
Many European countries, and particularly Poland, have long relied almost entirely on Russian sources when it comes to energy. Trying to look for alternative gas and oil providers is not really something new in Polish politics. But after Moscow pulled the plug on Ukraine earlier this year, and Germany signed a deal with Russia to pump natural gas under the Baltic Sea bypassing Poland, Warsaw is looking to diversify its energy supplies. Cooperation will be strengthened with Norway, and Poland is now also increasingly turning towards the Caucasus. Radio Polonia's Michael Zayen has the details.
Georgia's President Mikhail Saakashvili, on a visit to Warsaw, speaking about his country's NATO aspirations, of which Poland is a staunch supporter. Emphasis was put also on the two states' relations with Russia and cooperation in the field of energy. The Polish government regards as imperative the need to diversify the country's gas supplies. The urgency of the matter is further fueled by signals of a potential 2 billion cubic meter deficit for this winter alone. This greatly diminishes Poland's bargaining position with its main supplier, Russia. Professor Stanisław Gomułka, former lecturer of the London School of Economics, points out that Poland should look to the Caucasus and Central Asia for alternative sources of energy.
This is well recognized by the European Union, Poland and other countries like the United States, that Central Asian countries, in particular Azerbaijan and perhaps Kazakhstan and some other countries, may be a major source of oil and gas for parts of Europe, not to mention Ukraine. At some point, there will be a further enlargement of the European Union that would include Ukraine, and then it will become absolutely necessary for countries like Ukraine and Poland in particular, but also for other countries like Austria or even Italy, to have a separate source apart from Russia, in particular oil and gas, and to ensure that there is transportation that is not politically dependent on decisions in Moscow.
Another possibility for Poland is Scandinavia. The prime ministers of Poland and Norway have agreed that the two sides will return to negotiations, suspended under the former leftist government in Poland, to develop natural gas supplies to Poland. At present, 25% of European Union supplies come from Russia, and 80% of those flow through the territory of Ukraine. The recent gas price dispute between Moscow and Kiev led to a temporary reduction of supplies for some EU member states as well. Polish MEP Jacek Sariusz-Wolski claims that it is high time a common consensus was reached within the European Union on energy supplies.
The main problem is the political will of member countries to have kind of coordinated joint action in terms of supplies and transportation and sharing reserves, and in terms of more long-term policy on energy, in terms of diversification of sources of delivery, diversification of sources of energy itself.
Analysts say that this must be done fast, as growing gas prices, which loom over importers such as Poland, are making talks and decisions more and more complicated with practically each passing week. For Network Europe, I'm Michał Zając, reporting from Warsaw.
Taking off for your summer holidays abroad, it would probably not cross your mind that you could end up on the street begging for money and food. Yet in Stockholm, this seems to be the case. Volunteers who work with homeless people in the Swedish capital say the problem has become worse this summer, also because of the number of foreign tourists who are finding themselves sleeping rough in the city. They claim embassy staff aren't always doing enough to help people who get robbed of their cash and passports, leaving them stuck in Sweden with no other choice but to beg for money and food. Radio Sweden's Tom McElinden has more.
It's Monday lunchtime, and around 40 or so people are queuing up for a drink and some food at a soup kitchen that's set up daily here in the very centre of Stockholm. Volunteers say some are failed asylum seekers that have gone underground. Almost all of them are homeless, and it's just the tip of the iceberg. Inge Pagreus is a deacon at Stockholm St. Clara Church and has worked with homeless people for over 13 years.
It's a great problem. And we see as the church is located in the center of Stockholm, they come in all the time, homeless people, and try and seeking for help. And during the summer, it comes people from all Europe also. They come, they just go to Sweden, they travel around, and they come to Stockholm, and then they get robbed, and they have no money, and they have no passports, and they are just wandering around. And they can't get any help at all. So it's a great problem. I had a man from England this morning.
And they have nowhere else to turn to?
No. I phoned the embassy and they said no. We are not in charge of him. His relatives have to take care of him. So I phoned them, but they didn't want to help him.
A spokesman for the British Embassy in Stockholm says he would find it surprising that a British holidaymaker could end up sleeping on the streets and has never heard of it happening before. Neither had the Australian Embassy. At the American Embassy, though, they say it is certainly possible that one of their citizens could find themselves sleeping rough here with no means of getting home, and it has happened in the past. All three embassies say their citizens should always turn to them for help, and the level of assistance is decided on a case-by-case basis. She calls out to the man on the street, "Sir, can you help me? It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep." Foreign tourists aside, Inge Pagreja says the problem of homelessness in general is getting worse in Stockholm.
When I started to work here for about 13 years ago, then I could see that it was most elderly people, about 35, 50, that was heavy drug abusers and homeless. But now it's so young people. Young people around 20, they start going on heavy drugs, 20 and younger. And it also means when you're going heroin, you don't can afford to have a home. That's not what you want your money for. You need your money for the drugs.
One of the people Inga's talking about is sitting on a bench just a few yards away and agrees with what she's saying.
My name is Peter. I'm 39 years old. I'm homeless. I have four kids, a wife, and she wants to divorce.
How tough is it out living out here on the streets?
It's like living in hell. You have nothing. You are nothing.
Apart from the soup kitchen here, what kind of other help can homeless people get here in Stockholm?
There are some shelters, but it's no good. People have to live maybe among eight other persons, drug abusers, and very hurt people. It's not easy. So people in the summer, they prefer to stay outside. So the problem will be when it is the end of September, then everybody will see that we have a lot of homeless people in Stockholm.
Inge Pagreja is speaking to Radio Sweden's Tom Mekalinden about the problems of homeless people in Stockholm. Well, and having to sleep outside could also become a problem in southern Europe. Every summer, hundreds of thousands of North Africans living all over Europe head back south to spend their months-long European holidays in their native countries. Many go by car, which creates an enormous logistical problem when they arrive on the Straits of Gibraltar. Deutsche Welle's Jerome Sokolowski went to the port of Algeciras, where most of them catch the ferry to Morocco.
Every hour, more than 1,000 cars arrive here in the port of Algeciras. Most of them have Dutch, French and Italian license plates. Police in bright yellow vests guide them toward an asphalt waiting area the size of 35 football fields. It quickly fills up. There, they wait for the two-hour ferry ride that will take them to the Moroccan city of Tangier, across the Strait of Gibraltar. The vehicles are packed solid with almost every imaginable good. One old van has a bulging cargo on the roof, wrapped in a tarp. The driver, Ayashi Bin Saleh, works as a bricklayer on the French Côte d'Azur. He says he's taking gifts for his family and things for his home in Morocco.
Des affaires pour les cadeaux pour la maison, cadeaux pour la famille.
A bicycle for friends, for
His 16-year-old son, Hamed, says they're also taking along a refrigerator and two wooden doors. He says they're cheaper in Europe and the quality is better than what you can buy in Morocco. Saleh has made the trip back to his village near the desert city of Ouarzazate almost every summer since he moved to France 35 years ago. This summer, Spanish authorities estimate that between 2 and 3 million North Africans will cross the Strait of Gibraltar to spend their vacations. Most of those crossing here at Algeciras are Moroccans. Like other blue-collar workers in Europe, they get a month off every year. Many take it in August, which creates an enormous logistical challenge for the Spanish ferry ports. Every summer, port and law enforcement agencies cooperate in Operación Paso del Estrecho, Operation Crossing of the Straits. At the northern border with France, police count cars entering the country that are driven by North Africans. En route, the vehicles are directed to highway rest areas that are signposted in Arabic. And here in Algeciras, they're greeted in Arabic. They're given a chance to stretch their legs while they wait for the ferry. Alcazar, the port security chief, lists the facilities provided.
20,000 square meters of shaded areas, 57 drinking water stations, 75 benches, a mosque, 2 playing areas for children. We make an effort so that our clients will pass as quickly as possible and that their short stay is as pleasant as possible.
A decade ago, travelers could wait for up to 3 days in queues that extended out well beyond the city. Now, most cars are shepherded through quickly, although the wait on peak travel days can be up to 10 hours. A giant plasma screen shows music videos, soccer games, and Formula One racing to travelers waiting in their parked cars. The exodus is no longer exclusively made up of male workers or families cramped together in old clunkers like it used to be. There is a new generation of travelers like Turia Harmani and Aisha Boumni. Both left Morocco when they were children and are now 28 years old. They wear tight sleeveless shirts and drive a sporty black Renault with Dutch license plates.
Before family in Morocco, the most wonen wel in Nederland.
We have relatives in Morocco, although most do live in the Netherlands. But you go for enjoyment, for fun, and what else? For your culture, of course. Our culture is both Dutch and Moroccan.
You have to look at it this way. It's like the Dutch who've moved to Australia in the 60s. They're still stuck in the 60s. They wear wooden clogs. We Moroccans living in the Netherlands are still strict. But when I go to Morocco and see how the girls are dressed, then I think, hey, they are a lot freer than we are.
The Moroccan government wants people like Turia Harmani and Aisha Boumni to come back. Moroccan consular representative Khalid Aedar explains why.
So they don't lose their roots. So that even if they go to Europe or other countries, they always have Morocco in their mind. It's their land, their country. And Morocco also doesn't want to lose these people. They are a treasure.
Aedar points out that the homes they build and the wealth they bring are a big boost for the Moroccan economy. He says Morocco cooperates with Spain in the crossing by sharing anti-terrorism intelligence, especially when the travelers return to Europe at the end of August. Spanish authorities are mindful that those suspected of carrying out the 2004 commuter train bombings in Madrid allegedly belonged to a terrorist group based in Morocco. Manuel Alcazar, the port security chief, points to police with sniffer dogs checking a few cars already coming back from Morocco.
In the fight against terrorism, what's important is information. I have to say that the port of Algeciras, through its security corps, has a wide network of information. Many things are detected, and we've already responded quickly to quite a few situations.
Still, he concedes that in such a big operation, it's still possible for someone with ulterior motives to blend in with those returning to their jobs in Europe. Jerome Sokolovsky, Deutsche Welle Radio, Algeciras, Spain.
And while North Africans from all over Europe are heading down south for their summer holidays, figures released this week show that France has consolidated its place as the world's top tourist destination. 76 million people visited the country last year. This figure shows a slight rise on the previous year, largely due to an increase of Chinese tourists. But why is France so attractive? RFI's Hannah Godfrey reports from the French capital.
On average, European tourists spend €50 per night spent in France. Americans spend €162, but the Japanese are the big spenders. They shell out on average €204 for a night. With so many spectacular places in the world to visit, why do so many people who have the means to travel choose France as their destination? I asked this question to some visitors to France's iconic tourist attraction, the Eiffel Tower.
It's one of the seven wonders in the earth, in the world, so we have come to see this.
Well, the tower could be the number one attraction, the Seine is the other, or vice versa, and then you've got everything, haven't you? What else do you want?
Huh? Well, you haven't got the sea, you haven't got...
Oh, no, where I come from, the sea is only 4 or 5 miles away.
Where are you from?
Wales, UK. Yeah.
I've always wanted to come to France because of the Eiffel Tower and all the museums and all the buildings, lovely. And it's all what I expected.
Yeah? So it's as nice as you hoped?
Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. It's lovely. Everything's fantastic, yeah.
We are originally from Iraq, but we came from Sweden.
You live in Sweden?
We live in Sweden.
What are the main reasons why you come to France?
Well, there's many things to see here in France, especially the Eiffel Tower. Everything in here is different, not like Germany or any other places in Europe or even the Americas.
But other European countries have beautiful monuments. What's special about Paris?
Itself, it's special. I don't know. It has something special about it. Yes, every time you come, it's just magical.
But although all the visitors I spoke to said that France was living up to their expectations, there were some quibbles. The Welsh couple haven't found the French to be very warm hosts.
Not that over-friendly, no.
Do you think it's a language problem?
No, I don't think so. They say French is a bit arrogant, if I must say it. And they have proved that a bit, haven't they? The twice we sat by a bar one night and they didn't come for over 5 minutes to serve us. They were busy, but they didn't even say I'd be there now or anything. Yeah. So we went out.
Really?
Yeah. And now we just asked for information over there, and she was drawing, and she just said her answer. She didn't even look up, so we're used to being more friendly, I think, than they are in that way.
The only person who couldn't understand why France is the most visited country in the world was a French woman who works with tourists at the Eiffel Tower, making sure they form orderly queues.
We have nice pace, yes, but Italy or Spain are really fine. Also, it's a complete mystery.
But you work at the Eiffel Tower. You don't think the Eiffel Tower is the greatest wonder of the world?
Oh, yes. If you come to Paris, it's sure you have to come here.
I think that maybe Paris has a particular cachet that other countries don't have.
Yes, France is a romance. We have a long, long, long past of history. Maybe there is something like that in the air. I really don't know.
So you spend your life wondering why so many tourists want to come and see this tower?
Yes, sometimes yes. When there is a long, 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 long line, I really ask myself, why do they come?
RFI's Hannah Godfrey reporting from Paris, and that's almost all we've time for today. But before we go, here's another chance for you to participate in our monthly quiz. Is this the sound of freedom? Just maybe I'm crazy. The world's been running. Ukraine celebrates 15 years of independence this month. But although the Soviet Union broke up back in 1991, many consider the Orange Revolution in 2004 as Ukraine's real break with its Soviet heritage. This wild lady supported the revolutionists with her music. Prior to the Orange Revolution, she's won the Eurovision Song Contest in 2004. What is her name? You can email us your answer. The address is contact@networkeurope.org. And perhaps you could also tell us how you received the program. We have 5 prizes to give away and we'll announce the winners early September. The email address again, that's contact@networkeurope.org, or visit our website at networkeurope.org. We always like to hear from you. Network Europe receives funding from the European Union and is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Slovak Radio, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International, Radio Ukraine and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Barbara Gruber, leaving you with a summer hit from the Euro charts. It's called Coup de Boule or Headbutt, a song inspired, as you can imagine, by Zinedine Zidane's headbutt in the finals of the Football World Cup 1 month ago. We're back next week with a special on the European music scene. Thanks for tuning in. On a quand même bien rigolé. Zidane l'a frappé, Zidane l'a tapé. 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 Trezeguet n'a pas joué. Quand il a joué, il a raté. Il a tout fait capoter. La coupe, on l'a raté. Barthez n'a rien arrêté. C'est pourtant pas compliqué. Les sponsors sont tous. Mais Chirac a bien parlé. Zidane il a frappé, Zidane il a tapé. 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 Attention, c'est la danse du coup de boule. Coup de boule, coup de boule. Coup de boule à droite. Coup de boule, coup de boule. Coup de boule à gauche. Coup de boule, coup de boule. Coup de boule avant. Coup de boule, coup de boule. Coup de boule arrière. Et maintenant, penalty, attention, il va tirer. Un.